Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Mark Pelletier for Futures in Biotech, Episode 7, for Wednesday, October 18th, 2006, with Ronald DeRozier on the search for an HIV vaccine. Today with Dr. Ronald DeRozier. He's a professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at Harvard Medical School. He's also the director of the New England Primate Research Center, where he's been working for 28 years and the director since 1999. Dr. DeRozier discovered the closest known model for HIV, that is simian immunodeficiency virus, or SIV, and has been working on all aspects of its biology to identify its vulnerabilities, its Achilles heel. This model is really important because with it, you can proactively do experiments that you just cannot do on humans. So for upwards of 20 years, he's led the field to tackle one of the most daunting challenges to face humankind. Imagine a world without HIV. So here is our conversation.
My first question for you is, why are primates so suitable for animal models? How closely related are we?
The ideal animal model for AIDS would be one in which HIV infected and induced disease in the common laboratory mouse. That would be ideal. But unfortunately, that's not the case. The HIV is extremely restricted in the species that it will infect and will take in. And consequently, what my laboratory and many other laboratories around the world use is an analog model where we use the closest relative of HIV, a virus called simian immunodeficiency virus that infects and causes AIDS in the common laboratory rhesus monkey.
Well, let's take a step back for some of our listeners, and this might sound like a really simple question, but what exactly is a virus, and how does it compare to other pathogens like bacteria?
So viruses are the simplest of all infectious agents. They're not considered a life form, say as a bacteria or yeast or mold, which are living cells. Viruses are not cells. They're much smaller. Their genetic information is a tiny, tiny fraction of what a cell's genetic information is.
How many genes would be in a viral genome?
So the AIDS virus has 9 genes.
9 genes. So
right.
There's only 9 gene products.
And a human cell makes hundreds of thousands of gene products.
So how does 9 genes affect a patient or somebody who's infected with HIV?
I think that's the remarkable thing, and why it's so interesting to virologists. With such a small amount of genetic information, these viruses have crafted themselves in such an intelligent way that they can wreak enormous damage and have great survivability out in the world with just a small amount of genetic information. It really is remarkable.
So these are small particles. They're much smaller than a human cell. What do they sort of look like? Is it sort of a lipid or a protein coat then on top of the genetic material?
It varies. Some viruses are called envelope viruses, and that they have a lipid envelope bilayer that coats them. Other viruses are non-enveloped. They have no such lipid bilayer on their surface, and they're just really a tight ball of protein. So there are both envelope viruses and non-envelope viruses. One thing I should say that I forgot to say before is that viruses are totally dependent on host cell for their ability to replicate. So the viruses are not autonomously replicating, and that's sort of what distinguishes them from life forms. Life forms being cells, so bacteria or mammalian cells or human cells. Wow. Viruses are totally dependent on getting into a cell and dependent on the host cell machinery to make more of themselves.
You know, some people call them viral life cycles. So really, this is really, really on the edge of what you might start calling life. But I guess if they require a host cell, then without the host cell, they're really not considered alive. Is that sort of interpretation?
That's right. And most people draw the line, but viruses are dependent on cells for the replication and thus are not autonomously replicating. They're dependent on the host cell and thus are generally not considered a life form in that sense.
How did they start? How did the first virus start? Was it a cell that just started to evolve away from needing all the requirements of the cell?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. And how did life start?
It's very speculative. No. Chicken and the egg, the vaccine, and, or not the vaccine, but the virus in the cell.
I think most people think that life started as primitive forms of genetic information, maybe RNA, maybe even in some cases protein, but maybe RNA that somehow became able to replicate themselves and then evolved in such a way that over the course of millions of years became more... more complex and self-selecting.
So you think these the viruses actually were self-replicating particles and that evolved into, rather than being a cell that sort of downwards evolved towards the ultimate...
originally at the start, I think they started, most people think that they started from... autonomously, primitive forms of autonomously replicating material. But that's not to say that viruses have. There are many clear examples where viruses have captured host cell genes and then used them in the course of their evolution to their advantage.
Let me ask you, what exactly is a vaccine? So we've sort of got a good idea of what a virus might be. What is vaccine? And they've been developed for 50 or 60 years for a number of cases. What are they exactly?
Well, a vaccine is intended to prevent viral infection or prevent the disease caused by a viral infection. So it's either an attenuated form of the virus itself, or some subcomponent of the virus that results in an immune response, and that immune response can provide protection upon subsequent exposure to the live field strain of virus.
So it's part of the virus, or a virus that just can't replicate. how does this... I guess this is one of the main issues with HIV, is that it attacks the immune system, so... Can you tell me a little bit about what HIV is and how it causes AIDS?
Well, maybe I'll expound a little bit more on your previous question in terms of what are vaccines and how do they work. Historically, there have been two fundamental types of vaccines, live attenuated strains of virus and killed vaccines. So live attenuated vaccines are live replication competent strains of virus that through usually non-specific means they've been attenuated such that they're no longer able to cause disease. And so when an individual gets a vaccine strain of virus, for example the Sabin strain of polio vaccine, they have an immune response to it, they do not develop the illness, and they're protected against developing polio if they get exposed to a wild-type polio-causing strain of virus. The other major historical type of vaccine is a killed virus vaccine, where the wild form of virus is actually chemically inactivated so that it is no longer infectious, but it still has the viral proteins in it, and when that is given to a vaccinee, there's an immune response to those viral proteins, and that can be protective. And the classic example of such a killed virus vaccine is Jonas Salk's original polio virus vaccine. In more recent times, modern biotechnology has allowed production of subunit vaccines and recombinant viral vectors and all kinds of sophisticated means of providing immunization. However, there's really only one vaccine product that I'm aware of in human use that was derived by recombinant DNA technology, and that is the hepatitis B vaccine that's currently used in people.
Who did that vaccine? Was that Genentech? Or?
The rights are currently, for the hepatitis B vaccine, are currently owned by Merck, but I believe they bought the rights from it from Chiron. So I think the original work was done by Chiron, and now it's produced and marketed and sold by Merck. But I would need to do some fact-checking on that.
Well, that's a little bit of insider ping pong on my part.
We'll
here.
Have to check on that.
We're gonna,
I'm pretty sure it was originally produced
okay.
at Chiron and then eventually got sold to Merck, and Merck is the one that distributes it now.
I was just very, very curious. So I might actually edit that out.
But I mean, I think the story, the types of vaccines, and I think how in modern times it's allowed modern recombinant DNA technology to ways to develop vaccines is probably useful for your audience, in that there is one human vaccine that is actually developed by that means, but still only one.
I guess the ability to pick out one of those 9 proteins out of a virus, or I guess some viruses have more, and then test them for the ability to turn on the immune system, or, you know, to develop antibodies for it, is greatly useful to dissect. Maybe not necessarily make or produce a vaccine, but maybe engineer a virus that has the right keys.
Yeah, so in terms of developing an AIDS vaccine, it's still an open question whether one protein will be sufficient to provide protective immunity against AIDS, and if so, which protein might that be? That's unknown information right now.
Well, yeah, we're gonna get to that. I think some of the history on the molecular virology of HIV is just a remarkable story. Mm-hmm. And so let me ask you, how did you get started? Sort of with kind of a timeline. How did you get started working?
Well, in my own case, I was exclusively a herpes virus researcher. My laboratory was focused on herpes viruses and how they cause disease. And at the Primate Research Center where I work, we had an outbreak of disease where monkeys had this immunodeficiency and they were dying with opportunistic infections. And I decided to spend a certain percent of my effort looking to see what might be the cause. And that eventually led me to the discovery of SIV and in 1984, published in Science in 1985, and my life's really not been the same since.
Well, tell us a little bit about SIV. What is SIV, and how does it compare to HIV?
Well, SIV is the closest known relative of the human AIDS virus, HIV. It, like HIV, it contains 9 genes. There is a gene-for-gene correspondence in each of those 9 genes. Its biological properties are very similar to the human AIDS virus. It targets CD4-positive lymphocytes, and in the susceptible host, in the case of SIV rhesus monkeys, it causes an AIDS-like disease.
I was reading somewhere that the director of the institute that you work at was, you know, trying to get people to look at the monkeys that were exhibiting similar symptoms. This is well before the discovery of HIV, that these the monkeys, so you guys actually had monkeys that were having symptoms similar to those found in gay men in some parts of California.
That's correct. I remember rather vividly the director of our primate center in 1981 walking around the halls with the New England Journal of Medicine article when the description of AIDS first appeared. So it was 1981, and at the time it was called GRIDS, Gay-Related Immunodeficiency Syndrome. And he was waving the journal saying, look, this looks like what our monkeys have. This looks like what our monkeys have. And that was actually the impetus for me to say, okay, I'm going to spend a little time to see if I can find out what the cause may be.
Well, that's an incredible timing and place, you know, to sort of how many various kinds of diseases are the monkeys that you have? How many models? How many different kinds of sick monkeys do you have? That's my question. Because what are the chances that something that's still fairly, not necessarily rare, but not understood. What are the chances that you have access to monkeys with
well,
the same
symptoms? Well, you know, we have about 1,800 monkeys at any one time at our institution, and they're for the most part, very healthy. But they do get a collection of illnesses that are pretty closely parallel what one sees in human populations. Monkeys get cancer. Some of the cancers are related to viral infections. It's not a well-appreciated fact, but 20% of human cancers have a viral etiology, and there are related viruses in monkeys, and some of those viruses are also associated with similar cancers in monkeys. We have some monkeys that have neurologic disorders. Some monkeys exhibit signs of depression. So there's a wide range of potential disease types for study that are models of human disease.
So are you using rhesus monkeys primarily?
For HIV, we use, for SIV. As a model for AIDS in humans, we use almost exclusively rhesus monkey, which is an Asian old world primate. Natural habitat is India, China, and Southeast Asia.
What is our similarity in genome to the rhesus
genome is in the final stages of completion. So there's a draft genome sequence available online, and it's pretty close to complete. I've not actually sat down and analyzed it, and there's not been a publication to summarize it for me. But we have on occasion gone in and looked at the similarity of sequence in the rhesus versus human. And as you would expect, it being a monkey, it's not as similar to human as a chimpanzee is, but it's not too far off.
So we're talking 95 or better, probably. I think we're 95% cow.
Yeah, so we're in the 95% to 99% range.
Wow, that's amazing. So this SIV is a simian immunodeficiency virus, right? So yeah, and so here in 1985, you report the discovery of the simian immunodeficiency virus. It parallels the pathology of HIV. The timing, it was just remarkable, and the thrust to tackle this must have been huge. Were you running a small group, and then all of a sudden you had to hire on 30 people? How did the dynamics go to go after this? Because what a model to sort of figure out the biology.
It's important to remember that when the original New England Journal of Medicine article came out, there was really no way of knowing or predicting how important that was going to an important disease that was going to become. You know, it could very well have been possible that it was a sporadic, isolated report, and there would be no further word of it. So there was really, you know, as how important it's obvious now that AIDS is important, but it wasn't so obvious in 1981 that this was going to become a huge worldwide issue. But nonetheless, I decided to spend part of my effort going after it, and of course, with each 6 months, each 12 months, it became more and more clear that this was a huge issue.
And remarkably difficult, considering some of the things that SIV and HIV do. Mm-hmm. How many people, I think it's like 25 million people have died of HIV, AIDS? What is the sort of the rate of infections currently? And what, you know, in America, where there's treatment, but on a worldwide scope, what's the impact of HIV?
Yeah, this is not my area, and I'm not really up on the latest numbers. There is a website at WHO that gives the newest numbers each year for how many people worldwide are living with HIV, how many people estimated to have died from HIV up to this current point in time, how many new infections there have been in the past year. I think it's...
Well, I'll post that site, actually. I'll definitely post it. That's the great thing about doing a podcast or a netcast is that we can add links and people can, when they visit the site, they can pull this down.
For one of the classes I give in every November, I go back and I get the latest statistics to show to the class, but I just don't remember them off the top of my head.
Well, one thing, it must be a little bit scary, I guess, you know, to be working on trying to tackle a disease like HIV, knowing that there's, you know, upwards of, you know, 30, 40 million people that are living with it, and that their life could change dramatically if you manage to make an advance. So I guess sometimes it's best not to know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it's gratifying to know that I'm working hard and committing my career to something of enormous human importance where any advance, any discovery can really impact a lot of people. That's gratifying to know you're working on something important. But on the other hand, it's frustrating not to be able to make more advances and make more of a contribution, particularly since much of what I do is directed toward vaccine development. And it's really looking very, very, very difficult, and that's frustrating.
So let me ask you, why is it so difficult to work on HIV? What are the effects on our immune system of the virus? And tell us a little bit, possibly, about the strategies that this virus of 9 genes has been able to evolve to tackle us.
Making a vaccine against HIV really is different than anything that we faced previously. If by comparison, all the other vaccines in existence in human use are easy compared to what we face with HIV. If HIV had been any of these other viruses, we'd have had a vaccine by now. And the problem with HIV, what makes it so much more difficult, is really the virus itself and how it's shaped itself and how it replicates. HIV has evolved as its strategy for survival and an ability to replicate in the face of apparently strong immune responses. When an individual gets infected with HIV, they mount apparently strong antibody responses, apparently strong cellular immune responses, yet the virus manages to thwart those immune responses and continually replicate, and in the absence of antiviral drug treatment, eventually kill the host. And so for a vaccine to be effective, it needs to do something that the natural immune response does not do. In at least with the vaccines we've looked at to date, we throw up this immune system, and the virus is able to circumvent it and win, and that's tough.
Is this common amongst viruses to be able to do that kind of thing? You'd think it'd be the ultimate evolution of a virus to be able to say, well, there's an immune system here. I'm going to develop a protein that's going to knock off, you know, the immune system protein after protein. Is this common? I mean, I've heard of something like cytomegalovirus having a subset of genes that can just destroy the immune system from the inside out.
It is not common. The one could, if one looks at all viruses, one could categorize them in basically two classes, what are called acute viruses and persisting viruses. So acute viruses will replicate for a short period in an individual and then either kill the individual or be totally controlled by the host immune response and eliminated. So those viruses do not persist. They have an acute phase, and their survival in the population is dependent upon transmission from one individual to another during the brief window of time, usually a couple of weeks, in which it's replicating in an individual. The other major group of viruses are those that are able to persist in a single individual for the lifetime of that individual. But usually those viruses persist by remaining latent. So they're in the individual, but in their latent form, not causing disease. And the herpes viruses are the classic example of that. The virus that causes cold sores is a herpes virus. It remains latent for months and years, and under certain conditions can reactivate and cause a cold sore, but is largely latent. What distinguishes HIV is its ability to continuously replicate week after week, month after month, doing damage all the while. So although there are other classes of viruses that are persisting, they do not have the persistent, unrelenting replication that HIV exhibits.
Let me ask you, the genetic material from HIV and for example, herpes virus, do they, some of them remain encapsulated or being made in the various cells, but do others recombine into our human genome?
Herpes virus, herpes viruses are DNA viruses, and their genetic information remains, is extra chromosomal. That is, it they're covalently close circles, and for the most part, do not integrate with the host cell genetic information. The proviral DNA of HIV does integrate in with the genetic information and becomes an integral part of the host chromosomal DNA.
So that means that even if you had a vaccine in your body would have to continuously fight that virus if it's integrated into your system.
No, that's correct. Again, a vaccine is intended to be a preventive, and if you can make a vaccine that absolutely prevents the virus from entering any cells in your body, then you're fine. But you're right. Once the virus gets its foot in the door and it gets its genetic information integrated in the whole cell DNA, our experience has been with HIV and with SIV, that's trouble. And in the end, the virus is going to win.
How many different cell types does HIV use to replicate? Is it throughout the whole body, or is it specific cells?
There are two cell types that are generally accepted that HIV replicates in, can be found in, that is CD4 positive T lymphocytes and macrophages, which are also CD4 positive. CD4 is the receptor used by, principal receptor used by the virus for entry into cells. Now, those CD4 lymphocytes and macrophages can be found in all kinds of tissues, organs throughout the body.
And these lymphocytes are white blood cells?
T lymphocytes are one subclass of white blood cells. And those white blood cells can be found in the gut, in lymph nodes, in the spleen, all throughout the body. Macrophages, similarly, kidney, liver, lymph nodes, and in the brain.
Wow. So would there be a possibility to, once a person has it, to use some genetic manipulation or maybe engineer some the stem cells that produce the white blood cells or the source of those white blood cells to reverse engineer? Create a virus that goes and does exactly what HIV does in a targeted way and sort of knock out the genes? Or is that too far? Is that a crazy idea? Yeah. I don't know. I don't work with HIV, so I'm throwing
like
an idea out there. Maybe it'll stick.
Makings of a nice science fiction novel. There were,
right.
as you well know, there is a quite effective, highly active antiretroviral therapy available these days. It has really been, the greatest inroads that we've had against the virus. And there was some hope a few years ago that with even better, highly active antiretroviral therapy, that we could perhaps eradicate the virus from infected individuals such that it was, all traces were gone. But I think hope for that has faded, and I think it's unlikely that once an individual is infected that we're ever going to be able to rid the virus totally from the bodies of such individuals.
So where do we go? Where do we take this? What's the best strategy, in your opinion, to create a vaccine that will...
We have prevention, we have antiviral drugs, and we have vaccines. And I think if each of them have their pluses and minuses, their strengths and their limitations. I think prevention efforts are something that we need to absolutely continue. Prevention efforts can help limit the number of new infections, but we all know the limitations of preventions. People's behavior patterns are not foolproof. People willingly or unwillingly are going to continue to have unprotected sex. They're going to sometimes have sex with people they don't know their HIV status.
Well, that's really primarily the human life cycle. I mean, if we don't, then, you know, the human species won't exist. So that definitely, but I guess testing, which is unavailable in many countries, probably the key, right? Testing and
So prevention efforts should continue, but I think their impact is going to be limited. Antiviral drugs have had the greatest impact to date on HIV transmission and the effects of HIV in causing disease in individuals, and I think we should continue to try to improve upon antiviral drugs, make them more available to the developing world. But they're not the ultimate answer. They're not the ultimate solution. The real ultimate solution is a preventive vaccine that is cheap, safe, affordable, easily accessible to the world community, that can prevent the spread of HIV from one individual to another. We have such vaccines for other viruses. We have one virus that's been eradicated from the face of the earth by vaccination. We have another one that appears to be on the verge of eradication, poliovirus. And that would be the ultimate magic bullet for HIV, to have a safe, affordable, 100% effective vaccine. Unfortunately, development of a vaccine against HIV with any sort of efficacy at all is looking to be a very, very difficult problem.
Could you make a prediction? Would you be willing to make a prediction when we will be able to map that exact amino acid on the protein coat that will stimulate just the right?
Well, I'm happy to make a prediction as long as everyone realizes that it's my opinion and it's not some sort of scientific consensus. But I'm starting to feel that it's unlikely that we will have an effective vaccine in my lifetime. I also think it's possible that we may never have a vaccine.
Well, if we can figure out a way to turn it into a chronic disease, I guess that wouldn't be so bad, and make those drugs available to the people around the world. I think that's one of the major initiatives of Bill Clinton's post-presidential work, right?
It's better than nothing, but it's not an ideal. These drugs do have toxicity associated with them, particularly if you're talking about using them over the course of decades. A virus develops resistance to antiviral drugs, and so you have people who've been on antiviral drugs for several years develop a state of resistance, and virus reemerges in such individuals. There are individuals now whose virus is resistant to all known classes of anti-HIV drugs. So there are all kinds of problems. So yes, it's better than nothing, and turning it into a chronic disease as best we can is better than nothing, but it's not the ideal goal. I actually, what I'm most excited about is the idea of using antiviral drugs prophylactically. That is to have high risk, to put high risk individuals, commercial sex workers, individuals who have large numbers of sexual partners and are not willing to change their lifestyle through education, attempts to intervene with giving them better advice, to put such high-risk individuals or to recruit such high-risk individuals on taking antiviral drugs prophylactically as a preventive, such that when they do get exposed to HIV, it prevents the establishment of infection. I'm very excited about that as a possibility. There are models around that if you take the top 10% of high risk individuals, that you can have a much greater effect on the number of HIV preventions you can prevent in a year by focusing on the highest risk individual, the highest transmitters, or those most likely to transmit. And I think one way that we could get at a vaccine, so to speak, without actually being a vaccine, is to use antiviral drugs as a preventive.
Well, it sounds like a definite way to save lives. There's no question that if you can, you know, sort of get an idea of how and what we can do with this virus and know the limitations as well. You set out a plan, and no matter what that plan is, more or less effective, you're going to save thousands and thousands, if not millions, of lives, which is really remarkable. So I'm going to wish you good luck, and you know, keep up the amazing work you are doing with the SIV as well, the simian immunodeficiency virus. There's no question that you guys are really putting together the story that's going to help us tackle this.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for being on the show.
Okay, great.
That was Ronald DeRozier, professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at Harvard Medical School and director of the New England Primate Research Center. From the sounds of it, it appears that HIV has just about the 9 hardest genes to switch off. As mentioned before, he is working on a daunting task, but is providing fantastic information on how the disease can be tackled today. I'd like to thank Joanne Newton for coordinating the interview at the New England Primate Research Center, and Harry Gill and Mark Parker for revising the show notes. I'd like to thank the band Gunther for providing a theme for today's show. It is available at cyclonerecords.ca. And disclaimer, the ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the School of Medicine. This is Mark Peltier for Futures in Biotech. Thanks for listening.